and his professor. The two of them were engaged in a hushed conversation. When Val mentioned the professor, he glanced her way. Faint glimmers of streetlight flashed off his glasses.
Unfortunately, that doesn't make the danger to us any less.
The truck skipped through a pothole, and the passengers in the back screamed collectively, knocking shoulders and heads. Justin and his professor came crawling over.
I think I know what this is about, Justin said.
What do you mean?
Val asked.
A few weeks back, I entered a competition sponsored by Mensa. It was a recruitment thing for this super-secret group called Final Days. It's supposed to be about saving the human race and preserving its knowledge in the face of the looming environmental crisis.
And?
Val prompted.
And I passed. And they said someone would be contacting me soon for a face-to-face interview.
So what?
Val shrugged.
You missed your interview?
Justin's professor spoke next.
I entered the same competition.
I also passed.
And the next day, both of us are abducted by the same guy as you two,
Justin said. Val frowned, shaking her head.
But Anna and I didn't enter that contest. We're not even members of Mensa.
She nodded to the others in the container truck.
And I doubt the rest of these people are here because they wanted to join some apocalyptic fraternity.
That's not the point,
Justin said.
The point is, whoever these people are, they've been recruiting in a variety of places and in a variety of ways. And the recruitment method represented by the competition from Mensa suggests a purpose to all of this. Someone is organizing a group of people that they think will be able to reboot the planet after the dust settles.
So, you're saying it's a good thing that we were abducted?
Anna asked. The professor pushed his glasses up higher on his nose.
I think what Justin is trying to say is that we shouldn't give in to despair. At least, not yet.
Val nodded along with that.
I agree.
Well, I don't, Anna said. If this were about saving the planet, why send some creepo to abduct us? Why not just tell us what's going on, and why cram us all into a container like animals? This is what they do with slaves, right before they inject them with heroin and start pimping them out on street corners. I'm not waiting around for that. If I see a chance to escape, I'm taking it.
Anna, you could get yourself killed,
Justin said.
These guys all have guns.
You saw it when they herded us in here from that basement. They're not messing around. They'll shoot us if we try anything.
Exactly,
Anna blurted.
Guns, dingy basements, and container trucks. Does that sound like the Illuminati conspiring to save the world to you?
Val winced, hoping Anna was wrong. The truck lurched to a stop, and they heard doors banging open, followed by muffled voices and footsteps crunching in gravel.
We're here,
the professor whispered, his eyes going wide behind his glasses as he turned to look at the back of the container. Val felt Anna tense up beside her. Metal bolts screeched, and the rear doors groaned open. Dazzling white light barreled in from glaring spotlights, along with a cool, acrid mist.
Everybody out,
a man in military fatigues said, his voice muffled by a spray painter's mask. He gestured with the barrel of his rifle. A second guard stepped into view, a woman with razor-short blonde hair, also wearing military fatigues and a mask. She stood off to one side, aiming her rifle at them. People stirred and groaned as they clambered to their feet. Others shouted pointless questions like, "Where are we?" and "What do you want?" No answers came. Instead, the nearest of the two guards barked an order.
"Everyone into the warehouse, single file. I don't have all night."
Val stood up and shuffled toward the open doors with Anna, Justin, and the professor. She spotted a drone whizzing by in the background just above a chain-link fence with a curving row of barbed wire at the top.
Some kind of government facility?
She wondered. They reached the open doors at the back of the truck and shuffled through a puddle of urine that had sloshed out of the buckets. They jumped down one after another. The professor tried to do the same, but his knees gave out and he uttered a sharp cry.
You okay, Prof?
Justin asked, holding out a hand to help the older man up.
I'm fine, thank you, son,
the professor said as he took Justin's hand and regained his footing.
My knees aren't what they used to be, I'm afraid.
Val stood on the gravel lot looking around, trying to gain some sense of where they were. Dark shadows painted jagged shapes against the sky behind the fence. Trees. Cliffs. There were several guard towers along the length of the fence, with more guards up there covering them with rifles. Turning the other way, Val saw warehouses and moonlit ocean peeking between them.
"Follow the others,"
the man standing by the back of the truck snapped. He jerked his head toward the nearest warehouse. Big metal doors stood open, with another pair of armed guards in military fatigues standing there. Everyone from the truck was busy herding through single file. Val and Anna hurried to catch up. Justin and the professor stayed close on their heels. Anna found Val's hand and squeezed.
"Girl, are you with me?"
Anna whispered.
"Don't even think about it,"
Val whispered back.
"There's too many guards."
"Not now,"
Anna hissed.
"Later, when the time comes."
"If the time comes." But Val made herself consider it seriously. She suspected that Justin and his professor were right about this being some kind of end-of-days cult. But even if they were right, did she really want to be a part of that? She would probably never see her family again. No, Anna was right. They had to escape. Val squeezed her hand.
"I'm with you,"
she whispered.
"Good,"
Anna replied. And then they were slipping into a darkened warehouse under the hard, watchful eyes of two burly men with razor-short hair. Val tried to decide if they were in the military. The dog tags dangling from their necks suggested that they were, but unlike the first two, they weren't wearing fatigues. If this was a government-run operation, it was a black site. Val stepped into the warehouse, blinking fast to force her eyes to adjust to the relative darkness inside. The doors slid shut behind them, sealing them into a big, empty space. There weren't any guards on the ground floor, but plenty were standing on the walkways and catwalks of the upper level. Val's gaze skipped around, taking in her surroundings. Old, rusty pieces of ships littered the concrete floor. Pulleys and hooks dangled from the ceiling. The far end was open, revealing a concrete ramp leading to rippled water that was bright with moonlight. This was a dry dock.
"There's more people here than we thought,"
Justin whispered. Val dragged her eyes away from the water to see that he was right. There had to be at least a few hundred people here, all bumping shoulders, murmuring and muttering, screaming out questions to the guards peering over from the second floor. A group of four people came striding across a metal catwalk that crossed the cavernous dry dock like a bridge some four floors up. The procession stopped in the middle, and someone with a deep voice began to speak.
"I know you must all have a lot of questions. I regret the necessity of bringing you all here like this. The good news is, it's over now. And it was all for a good cause. The very best. You're here to ensure the survival of the human race."
The speaker paused, and Justin let out a breath.
"See," he said, "what did I tell you?"
Val scowled. Smug wasn't a good look on him.
"I know that man," the professor added.
"You do?"
Anna asked, squinting up at the dark figure standing above them.
"That's the tech billionaire, Lewis Hound."
Val blinked in shock. Everyone recognized that name. Lewis Hound was one of the richest men on the planet.
"What's he doing here?"
Hound went on.
"All of you are here because you were chosen, selected personally by me for two important sets of criteria. The first being your exemplary genetics, and the second being your knowledge and skills. Together, we are going to survive the final days of humanity. And we will rebuild our great civilization from the ashes of its destruction. Welcome, all of you, to the Eden Project."
A few cheers went up from the guards on the second floor, along with a scattering of relieved sighs from the people on the ground, but by far the biggest reaction was confusion. More muttering and hushed whispering, followed by a man shouting a question.
"And what if we don't want to be a part of this project? Can we leave?"
A few others seconded that. Silence answered them. Val held her breath, her gaze skipping between armed guards on the second level. A few of them shifted their footing, their guns rattling ominously.
The crowd receded around the man who'd asked the question, as if they were busy worrying about the same thing. You didn't abduct people at gunpoint just to let them go later without a fight. Kendra. Hours. It took hours and hours to maneuver across town to the Tesla house, and when she did, Kendra was sure she saw the taillights of a familiar black truck tearing down the street. Her pulse quickened as she searched the block looking for any signs of the Tesla from the abduction footage. Someone had left in a hurry. Garbage bins were knocked over, pouring their contents out onto the sidewalk. No one was going to pick that up. Judging by the traffic she'd endured today, there wouldn't be anyone left in San Diego by morning. Kendra pulled to the end of the driveway and threw the car in park. Did it even matter what she found inside? In a few days it wouldn't. Kendra rubbed her eyes, watching the house first. Really, she was giving herself time to make an excuse and leave. She had a bag of clothing in the trunk, and she could head for Houston along with everyone else, make camp at the FBI office, and live to see another day. That's what she should do. People still needed her around. That woman and her children had nearly been killed, but Kendra had helped them. She could do that in Houston. When the world went to hell, she'd be there to pick up the pieces. "Carrie, what do I do?" she asked her sister. She used to do this all the time, and her own words startled her. It had been at least 5 years since she'd said her sister's name out loud in this manner, and she almost chided herself. Her sister had been the family's pride and joy. She'd enrolled in college at the tender age of 16 with full scholarships. She was almost done with her degree in astrophysics when she was abducted from campus. Kendra recalled the news coverage, her parents pleading for their daughter's life while younger Kendra stood to the side of the podium, awkward and red-eyed. She felt like that little girl now, and she needed her sister's advice. "What do I do?" she asked again, and noticed the door beside the garage was ajar. It wasn't a sign from her sister, but she thanked her silently for the urging. Kendra walked the driveway, her 9mm pressed firmly into her grip. It had already been discharged today, and she hoped she wouldn't need to use it again. Her hand shook slightly as she thought back to the body lying on the street, the once crazy eyes settled into a vacant stare. She stepped into the garage, which was empty, save for a few tools and a freezer. Not the garage of someone here for a long time. "FBI, come out with your hands up," Kendra shouted as she stepped into the mudroom. She listened for any noises within the house, but heard none. She moved now, slowly but efficiently. The kitchen had some half-eaten packages of snacks on the counter, and the living room looked like someone had been sleeping on the couch. A cold cup of coffee sat on an expensive coffee table without a coaster. That told her the person wasn't the homeowner. Then she saw the hutch. It sat in the middle of a hall, the floor scratched and scraped. Behind it was a small doorway, the jambs torn apart. A deadbolt lay on the first step, still stuck to part of the wooden door. Kendra could already smell the basement, and she knew the scent only too well. It was the smell of captivity. Working for the Missing Persons Department under the Violent Criminals Apprehension Program of the FBI, she'd seen every type of scenario, but almost every time, it ended with a dark room, a mattress on the floor, and that smell. She fought a gag reflex she never used to have and took one creaky step at a time. She stepped over a 2x4 and landed at the bottom of the stairs. The far corner held a makeshift bed. There were a few supplies near the area, and the entire sight pushed a profound resentment throughout her body. This was why she worked so hard. This was why she'd become an FBI agent, to stop this from happening. Where was the body?
"FBI, if you're down there, I'm here to help,"
she said loudly, the sound dying on the unfinished concrete walls. The whole space was bereft of light, and she held her cell up, illuminating her surroundings. The man's head lolled to the side, a splatter painted the gray walls behind him. Kendra went to his side, but didn't need to check his pulse. There was no point. He was dead, shot point blank by something with some kick to it. He wore an expensive suit, his shoes black and shiny. This was David Wilkes, Mr. Tesla himself. This was the last thing she'd expected to come across in this house. If he was dead, the answers she'd been searching for were gone with him. How was she ever going to find the abducted people now? She stepped away from the body and knew there was only one person that seemed to be one step ahead of her, the man in the Silverado, the man with the pain in his eyes and the claim that his daughter was taken. How could a civilian have found Wilkes before her? He had to be in on it. Maybe he was the muscle hired to tie up the loose ends, or he could be the nondescript leader behind it, making sure no one talked. Offing Wilkes would make sense then. Was he the one who'd been chained to the bed? It didn't add up. She guessed this Wilkes guy had kept someone detained in the basement. It looked like a dozen other crime scenes she'd bore witness to over the years. Kendra left the basement with more questions than answers. She needed a lead and was determined to find something in the house. She doubted the guy who'd left the body in the basement would have spent too much time investigating the home, so that's what she was going to do. She started upstairs, noticing a dent in the wall. She placed her fist in the hole and assumed someone had punched the drywall in anger. Did Wilkes have a bad temper? She moved to the master bedroom. The drawers in the nightstands were open, their meager contents tossed onto the floor, so the house had been searched. She found nothing inside but continued looking, hoping to find a cell phone or a laptop. The other two guest rooms were sparsely furnished and resulted in nothing of use. Frustration grew in Kendra's mind, but she pressed on, checking through the entire main level. She spent 2 hours rummaging for hidden compartments, for anything that might be of use. She took pictures of the kitchen, the calendar on the wall, but none of the notes made any sense. She slumped to the couch in exhaustion and wondered if she'd be able to stand up again. Today had been a long day, mentally and physically tiring. But the memory of the body in the basement and the one she'd left on the street was enough to motivate her after a few minutes' break. The fireplace beckoned to her, and she noticed the chip on one of the tiles. She rose from the cushions, her muscles protesting the move, and ran a hand along it. The 1x3 gray slate tile was loose, and she used her nails to pry it off. "Bingo," she said, grateful for any sort of wind today. A folder sat in a roughly dug-out hole butting up against the flue of the fireplace. She took it and flipped it open. "It's them," she whispered to herself, seeing the familiar names. They were all on there. Professor James Hughes, Commander Tess Anderson. She scanned the list, wondering after one name in particular, and saw it near the bottom. Valeria Miller.
Son of a bitch.
It was the girl the man in the Silverado had mentioned was his daughter. She wasn't sure if she could buy it or not, but it was a start. There was only one lead, and it was with Valeria Miller's father. Kendra left the house, turning the lights off for no other reason than habit, and for the second time in one day, she didn't call anyone to tell them of a dead body. No one was listening anyway. She drove home, the roads much quieter now. Sirens echoed through greater San Diego like a constant reminder that the world was ending. People blew through intersections, and she was careful to watch for errant drivers as she wound her way toward her condo unit. The parking lot was empty when she arrived, and she hoped that all of them had made it somewhere safe. The odds weren't in anyone's favor. Kendra took the newly found folder but left her luggage in the trunk. She couldn't predict when she'd need to make a quick getaway. Once inside, she locked the door and took a deep breath. This was her safe zone, but there'd be no sleeping without her gun tonight. Her navy blue blazer fell to the couch, and she kicked off her shoes, her feet, instantly thanking her. She moved to the fridge and tried to push the events of the last week out of her mind. Empty. She found a bottle of red wine in the cupboard and uncorked it before pulling a glass from inside her cabinet. She was going to miss this place, her little sanctuary. Soon it would be swallowed by the angry earth. It might not be lavish, and She could hear the droning of her neighbor's TV when he had friends over to watch football games, but she'd grown accustomed to all of its nuances. It was the first place she'd ever felt at home, at least since her sister had been with her at their parents' house. She'd left too early, too young, leaving Kendra at the mercy of their strict and structured mother. Kendra sat at the island, unbuttoning her shirt. The wine was tart, and she swirled it around her mouth, acclimating her taste buds to the flavor. An old boyfriend had taught her that move. She laughed to herself at the casual use of the word boyfriend. The truth was, they'd gone on a couple of dates, but the moment she'd let herself become vulnerable with Devin, he'd said she was too cold, too distant. She saw him at her favorite restaurant a few days later with a younger woman, probably a college student from the looks of her. That had been 2 years ago. "None of that matters now," she said out loud, sipping her wine. Her shower called to her, and she cranked the heat up, the mirror already steamed by the time she stepped into the water. It scalded her, but it was what Kendra needed at the moment. She washed off the blood of the man she'd killed today, atoning for her sins with a burning sensation. She wondered if this was what hell felt like. Kendra shut the water off, the faucet dripping to the shower's tile floor, and she slid down the wall, unable to hold in the tears any longer. They flowed like rain, and she rocked herself, trying to calm her fried nerves. Eventually, she peeled herself from the shower and straightened her posture as she looked in the mirror. The puckered scar where a bullet had torn through her left shoulder 6 years ago stood pronounced and angry after the hot shower, and she ran a finger over the old injury. Even though she didn't think of it much after all this time, she was still self-conscious of its appearance, especially after Devin had told her it was a turnoff to hear she'd been shot. Kendra found her reflection was smiling back at her, and she was startled by it. She felt renewed by the entire experience, reborn. With a new resolve to solve this case, she folded a towel around her hair and threw a bathrobe on. She would find the Silverado in the morning. If Miller was still in town, she was going to find him and get her answers. This might be her last case, but she was going to solve it. She stared at the list of names, running her finger alongside each person, as if memorizing the missing names would make them more real, more tangible. 16. Andrew. 4 days left. Andrew raced away from David Wilkes's home, driving aimlessly to distance himself from the body he'd left behind. He couldn't afford to get arrested, not until he found Val. He glanced at the passenger seat where David's laptop and phone sat. Both of them were password locked, but that wouldn't stop a computer hacker. He just had to find one. Streetlights flashed by in golden streaks to either side. Crashed and looted cars littered the street, especially at intersections where people had run the lights. Somehow, while he'd been in Wilkes's place, the world had gone to hell. The city was truly deserted now. Scraps of garbage went blasting by in a gale-force wind. San Diego had probably officially evacuated at this point. The windows of stores and cafes lining the streets were all shattered. Entire plazas were ruined, the parking lots littered with garbage, even a few gleaming specks that he suspected might be shell casings. Andrew drove by a supermarket with a guy doing donuts in the parking lot with his truck. The guy in the passenger seat was screaming like a madman and firing a semi-automatic rifle in the air. Not far from that, some kids jumped out in front of him, laughing and throwing empty beer bottles at his Silverado. Andrew cursed and swerved. They narrowly escaped being run over. Apparently, the only people left in the city were either insane or suicidal. Andrew absently wondered where he fit on that spectrum. It was after midnight by the time he decided to pull off the chaotic streets and take cover around the back of a motel. He was planning to just kick in one of the doors and then block it with furniture while he rested and figured out what to do next, but he'd broken enough laws for one day, so he went to the front office to see if anyone was still around. This time he was prepared for whatever flavor of crazy the owner might be serving, and he took his gun with him.
The front doors were locked and no lights were on. Andrew rattled the doors loudly. A whistling wind blew across the parking lot and he shivered. This was stupid. No one was here. He turned away from the doors and walked around to where he'd parked his truck. He entered a dark, open corridor that crossed from one side of the main building to the other. That corridor also housed a stairwell to the second floor. As Andrew neared the stairs, he felt the skin on the back of his neck prickle and a deep voice stopped him cold.
"Drop the gun and kick it away."
A familiar click sounded next, the action of a revolver cocking. Andrew dropped his gun and kicked it a few feet from him before raising his hands and slowly turning to face whoever had just ambushed him. He was getting sloppy. He should have stayed alert rather than assume the place was abandoned. Better yet, he should have completely avoided motels after his last experience. The guy covering him was tall and skinny with blonde hair pulled into a ponytail and a thick mustache clinging to his upper lip. Cigarette smoke wafted off the guy's clothes in noxious waves. The revolver turned out to be a gleaming silver .357 Magnum.
"Are you the owner?" Andrew asked mildly. "Or do you care?"
the guy challenged.
"I was looking for you. I want a room. I can pay. Cash."
The owner snorted and made a gimme gesture with one hand.
"Okay, let's see some green. Slowly."
Andrew caught a glimpse of the dog tags dangling from the guy's neck. It could just be jewelry, but he decided to take a gamble. "Army?" he asked as he withdrew his wallet and pulled out two 20s.
"National Guard, 79th Infantry Brigade,"
the guy said. He took the bills and pocketed them. "I was a Marine corporal with the 24th Expeditionary," Andrew said. "Fought in Afghanistan back in 2008.
"You don't say."
The guy didn't bat an eye.
"Is that supposed to make me feel all warm and fuzzy?"
"I guess not. Look, I just need a place to regroup for a bit. The streets are crazy and I don't want to get hijacked while I'm pulled over somewhere."
"I hear you. The trouble is, I don't want to get shot in the head for being the good Samaritan who gave you a room. So, I'll tell you what. You want to stay here? You leave your gun with me until you're ready to leave."
Andrew considered that. He didn't seem to have much choice. "All right."
"Glad we could come to an understanding. Move away slowly from the weapon. I'll pick it up. And then you follow me to the front office and we'll set you up with a room key. You got your pick of the whole joint tonight."
The man smiled, revealing cigarette-stained yellow teeth. Andrew did as he was told and then went with the owner, marching ahead of him with two guns aimed at his back.
"What's your name?"
he asked.
"Seth."
"I'm Andy."
"Nice to meet you."
Andrew was waiting for some indication that he was about to get shot in the back, but it never came. Something about Seth seemed genuine. He pocketed Andrew's gun and unlocked the front office with one of a thousand different keys jangling on a big silver loop clipped to his belt.
"Why haven't you evacuated yet?"
Andrew asked as he walked into the office.
"To tell the truth, I don't buy it,"
Seth said. He walked around behind the front desk and opened a drawer, making sure to keep Andrew covered with his Magnum the whole time. Andrew heard keys jangling again as Seth rifled around inside his desk.
"I mean, who ever heard of Mother Nature coordinating disasters? Somehow the San Andreas is going to knock half of the state into the Pacific, and at the same time, Yellowstone is going to blow her top. Doesn't add up. Something else is going on, and I want to be around to see why they're really evacuating everyone. That, and I don't want to come back to find my motel trashed by a gang of drunken end-of-the-world partiers."
"Yeah, that makes sense, I guess," Andrew said. "Maybe Seth was right." The motel owner handed him a key for room 201.
"That's the best I've got. It has a kitchen, a nice view of the city, and it's on a corner on the second floor, so you'll have some warning if there's any trouble coming."
"Thank you," Andrew said. "You have Wi-Fi here?"
"Yep. Password is in the room on the nightstand."
"Perfect. I'll come for my gun at checkout.
Where do I find you here? Andrews suggested, nodding to the front desk.
Sure, why not?
Andrew wasn't sure how far he could trust this guy, but so far Seth hadn't tried anything. On his way to the suite, he went back to his truck and grabbed David's laptop and phone. Maybe he'd get lucky and guess one of the passwords. Up on the second floor, he walked around, checking the green doors until he found one with the number 401 stamped on it in cheap peel-and-stick gold numbers. His corner suite stank of smoke and old musty carpets, but it would do. He locked the chain on the door and jammed a chair under the door handle for added security. He went to find the Wi-Fi password and connect his phone. Thankfully, the connection worked and Google loaded in just a few seconds. He had a data connection, but it wasn't unlimited, and he didn't want to use up all of his bandwidth, only to find himself tapped out when he really needed it. Andrew sat on the bed running Google searches for hackers that he could hire. The second result was Computer Wizardry and Hackery for Hire, www.digitalwizardry.com. He tried the link, browsed to the contact area, and filled out the form. He wrote a brief summary of what he needed and why. Help breaking into a phone and a laptop in order to turn up leads and find his missing daughter. He also mentioned his current location as San Diego and left his cell number for an additional means of contact. When he was done, he hit send, receiving an automatic response from the site. Thank for your inquiry. The digital wizard will get back to you in his next clock cycle. Andrew frowned at that, wondering if the guy behind the site would actually see his message or even respond to it if he did. He picked up David's phone and depressed the power button. The lock screen appeared. A pattern lock. Maybe he could guess it? He turned off the phone and slanted it toward the light to check the pattern of finger grease on the screen, but it was smeared into oblivion. He tried 5 different patterns, all wrong, and ended up locking himself out for a minute. Andrew kept that up for the next hour, waiting a minute between each set of 5 wrong patterns, but he soon lost track of all the different combinations he'd tried. How many possibilities were there? Thousands? Millions? He gave up and rolled over with a sigh. That was when his phone began buzzing and ringing with an incoming call. He sat up in a hurry and snatched his phone off the bed to see who it was. Maybe it was that FBI agent. His heart sank when he saw who it actually was. Just Selena again. This time he answered.
Hey.
Andrew, you asshole! She screamed in his ear. I've been going out of my mind. Where are you? Have you found Val yet? The president issued an official evacuation for the entire West Coast.
I'm still here, nosing around. I'm working on some leads. He didn't have the heart to tell her that he'd found the guy who'd taken Val, nor did he want to spread David's sick and obviously false claims about what he'd done with her.
What leads?
Selena insisted. He told her about the laptop and phone he'd stolen that belonged to a guy seen fleeing the scene of an abduction at UC San Diego. He skipped the part about having interrogated and shot that guy in the head.
You need to see what's on them, Selena said.
I'm working on it. I'm busy trying to find a hacker who can break the security. Listen, I have to go, but I'll call you if I turn up anything else.
You've only got 4 days, Andrew. That's it. You better find her before that, or so help me.
Selena trailed off in a sob. I will. Stay safe and keep your phone close. He ended the call and sprawled on the bed, staring at the popcorn ceiling and wishing like hell he had a drink. With every setback along the way, his despair and desperation grew, and the monster inside of him with it. He found himself absently toying with the 90-day sober chip around his neck. That chip was a lie now, but Val had been his strongest supporter, and she'd bought him the necklace that the chip hung from. Right now, that thin band of silver felt like the only connection to her that he had left. A sharp pain began in his throat, constricting his breathing to shallow gasps and making his eyes feel hot.
I'm not giving up on you, Val,
he whispered. He'd keep searching to the very end, even if he ran flat out of time and got tossed into the ocean right along with the California coast. Andrew sat up and rubbed his tired eyes to search for another hacker he could hire. If he contacted enough of them,
At least one was sure to answer.
17. Kendra. 4 days left. The day after the evacuation notice, San Diego was a ghost town. Garbage was strewn about, cars burned on the side of the streets.
This is what happens to humanity under pressure. Instead of uniting to achieve a goal, they destroy everything they worked so hard to build.
Kendra shook her head as she pushed her disdain to the side. She'd had trouble sleeping last night, and the coffee wasn't strong enough this morning. There were no stores open, so she had to rely on her own brew from home, and she took another swig, tasting grounds between her teeth. When she'd first moved to the city, she'd loved it. She'd had aspirations, so many dreams that never came true. She was going to learn to surf, to buy a paddleboard and spend weekends in the water, just her, the board, the sand, and the sun. She'd only been in the ocean twice over the years, and once was when an old FBI acquaintance from out of town came to visit. She'd wanted to make the woman think she was embracing the coastal dwelling. The truth was, Kendra had never felt at home here. She missed the smells of crops in the summer, the flat Midwestern land, the friendly faces. She missed her sister most of all.
God damn it, Ken! Get it together, she's gone!
Kendra slapped the steering wheel with a palm, hard enough to hurt.
She's gone, and if you're not careful, you'll be gone too.
The roads were dead, a complete juxtaposition to yesterday's entire day of gridlock. A streetlight turned red, and she instinctively pressed the brake, rubbing her head as the car idled at the light. A horn blared, and a banged-up Ferrari tore through the intersection, its exhaust sounding like a sonic boom. She expected to see a plume of smoke as it crashed into a street pole a block away, but it didn't. She could still hear it as it drove farther and farther away.
"Looky what we have here," a voice said through her open window, and Kendra spun to see a group of men approaching the car.
A few settled in front of the vehicle before she could drive away. They were thugs, undoubtedly. She'd seen their type a million times. They were always lurking in dark corners, waiting for someone weaker than them so they could exploit them, use them, steal from them, or worse. Not today. More of them emerged from the other alley, and Kendra didn't hesitate. She pulled her gun out, flashing the steel, and the lead man raised his hands in the air.
"We only want your car,"
he sneered at her with squinted eyes, his face wild, twitchy.
"Move!"
she shouted to the guys standing near the front of the car with bats in their hands. She was feeling twitchy herself. When they didn't move, she knew what she had to do. It was the end of times, and she didn't need to play by the rules anymore. It was survival. Someone was at the passenger side of her car testing the handle, which was locked. He pulled his bat away, ready to smash the glass, and she gunned the gas pedal, sending three men barreling to the side. One of them was on her hood, and she heard a bottle hit the trunk as the thugs threw more toward her. Kendra panicked, jerking the steering wheel left and right, trying to toss the bastard off her hood. He gripped the windshield wipers, his gap-toothed smile wide. She pulled the washer fluid lever, sending liquid shooting at his face. He rolled off as she took a hard left turn, narrowly missing a bus bench on the sidewalk as she hopped the curb. Kendra kept driving as the man spun on the pavement, coming to a halt. She was off target by a couple of blocks by the time she slowed, adrenaline pumping through her body. If anyone had stayed behind, like the group that had come for her, they'd be sticking to the main routes, knowing most people would be using them to get around. Kendra decided to use side streets to the office. With no lights to worry about, or traffic, it wouldn't take long at all. She was optimistic she'd find something in the pictures from Mr. Tesla's house, but she was still pissed there hadn't been a laptop in sight. Kendra felt this case was slipping away from her. She slowed at the sight of a low-rent motel. A sole vehicle sat in the parking lot, backed into the spot for a quick exit. It was a black Silverado. Could it be the same one she kept running into? She kept driving, trying to think what her best move was. This guy had talked to her at the university. He'd watched her in the cafe from the street, and he'd obviously been the one to kill Mr. Tesla. If anyone knew what was going on, it was him. Could she go cuff the guy and force him to talk?
He was tough and carried himself with a demeanor that shouted ex-law enforcement or military. She wasn't sure knocking on his door would be the most prudent course of action, so she circled around the block, stopping beside a 24-hour laundromat. The windows were smashed, and quarters spread out across the sidewalk. Kendra scanned the mirrors, making sure no one was going to sneak up on her, and set her Glock in her lap, stretching over for the glove box. She had a few tricks she kept with her at all times, and she was glad to be able to use one of them. The GPS unit was tiny. She slid it from the matchbook-sized box and placed it on her fingertip. It was no larger than an Advil. She linked it to her cell phone and watched as the light blinked, displaying its current location on a map. This guy was either who he said he was and was the world's best detective, or he was involved, killing Mr. Tesla to tie up loose ends. Either way, he was going to lead her to the missing people. She was sure of it. The air felt electric as she stepped onto the sidewalk, her gun safely in its holster. She moved quickly and efficiently, constantly scanning for trouble. A gunshot rang out in the distance, momentarily stopping her, but she moved again, with fluid purpose. The motel was there, the lights flickering on and off on the red letter M. A shadow moved behind curtains in one of the rooms near the Silverado, and Kendra crouched low, crawling to the front of the vehicle. She crept to the passenger side away from the windows and placed the miniature device into the wheel well, making sure it stuck firmly. She clutched her cell phone as her shoulders pressed against the side of the truck. The light blinked, telling her the GPS was functional. Kendra thought she could hear the man inside talking to someone, or to himself, and she took a deep breath. It was time to get out of here. She glanced up at the room. He was so close. She could burst in, point the gun at the man, and demand to know where the abducted people were stashed. Carrie's face appeared in the back of her eyelids, smiling at her. She pushed it away. Minutes later, she was in her car, heading for the FBI field office, already exhausted from the morning's events. She arrived unimpeded 10 minutes later and found the glass door to the office locked, with a note taped to it from the inside. "This office is closed. Any agents can reconnect at our Houston office. Log into your account for more details. We apologize for any inconvenience." "What a crock," Kendra whispered as she pulled her key from her pocket. Luckily, it still turned, causing the bolt to snap open. Kendra locked it up again as she stepped into the entrance, wondering why no one had contacted her about them shutting the office down. It was just like them to leave her on the outs. Houston. It felt so far away. The office was half empty. The computers sat in a pile, taken apart and beaten from the looks of it. Of course, they would have wiped the drives before doing this, but the image was symbolic for what was to come. This was the end. The president knew it. The FBI director knew it. Kendra had been hoping they were wrong, that the storms, the volcanoes, the tsunamis were only theoretical, but intuitively, she'd always known it. The world was about to change. Looking outside, it was clear it had already begun, even without the disasters striking yet. There had been warning signs, and over the last decade, so many disasters had struck around the planet. Had no one been able to put two and two together? Kendra moved toward her office and saw her own desktop computer was missing. She didn't need it. She wondered if her space had been ransacked, but remembered there was nothing in it to start with. No pictures, no personal items, nothing. She'd worked here 5 years, and there was no evidence she'd ever spent a day in that office. Houston. Would it be so bad? She could team up with the rest of the Bureau and try to help after the disaster struck. What would the country look like? What was this going to do to the world? Kendra imagined the new planet after the events transpired. Estimations said that over half of the United States population would be gone within the first week after the ash began to fall. The series of brewing hurricanes would wipe out most of the Caribbean. Europe was up in the air, but with the looming eruptions, it wasn't going to be pretty. She ran a hand over the files she dropped to the desk and opened it up, scanning over the faces of the missing people. Didn't they deserve a chance?
Would their world end as they sat tied up in a basement somewhere? The entire case had Kendra's insides twisted up. They had to be connected, especially with the Tesla man being near for a few of them. She was sure the others around the country were taken in similar styles, but to what end? Why abduct doctors, scientists, professors, teenagers as well? Then it hit her like a slap in the face. Someone planned to start over. To do so, they'd need skilled people on hand. Her heart raced as she considered the implications, but her attention was pulled away when her cell phone chimed, and she saw what she'd been waiting for. The black truck with the GPS device stuck to it had begun to move. She grabbed her files and ran for the exit. It was time to find out what the hell was going on. Val. Val's entire body flooded with adrenaline. The guards on the second level of the dry dock looked like they could open fire at a moment's notice. Her gaze snapped back to Lewis Hounds standing on the catwalk above them. The crowd of abductees was still trying to edge away from the man who'd asked Lewis if they'd be allowed to leave his secret end-of-days club.
"If you don't want to be a part of the Eden Project," Lewis Hounds began slowly, "then, yes, you may leave. But first, I'd like to ask for a fair chance. You need to see what this is all about before you make such an important decision. As such, none of you will be allowed to leave until we arrive at the Eden facility." The dry dock filled with worried murmurs and a rising roar of discontent. Now that Lewis had claimed to have a good reason for abducting them, people were becoming more brazen about questioning his motives. A few people even began shouting out insults.
"Come on, don't be stupid," Justin muttered.
"Do they not see how many guns are aimed at us?" Val added.
"Don't worry," Lewis said, raising his hands for attention. "I'm not here to keep you in suspense. We're leaving for Eden right now." He turned and nodded to something out on the water at the open end of the dry dock. It was only then that Val noticed the glinting lights bobbing over the water and the rising whine of motors. All of a minute later, a group of 8 large Zodiac boats pulled up on the concrete ramp at the open end of the dry dock. Armed guards piled out and began gesturing to them. From the catwalk above, Lewis Hounds spoke once more.
"Who wants to go first?"
To Val's surprise, Anna hurried toward the boats, pulling her along by the arm.
"Hey, slow down!
Let's go!"
Anna whispered sharply. Justin and his professor followed, pushing through the crowd to join them. They reached one of the boats and clambered over the front with a group of at least 20 others. There were 2 people in the back standing under a covered section, a man keeping the passengers covered with his rifle, and a woman manning the controls. A pair of men crawled in over the bow, and the Zodiac reversed out of the dry dock and went skipping over the choppy water, aiming for a big white and red container ship on the horizon.
"Had a change of heart about this situation?"
Val asked over the roar of the outboard motors and the cold wind whipping off the water. Anna didn't reply. She was busy whispering something to her brother, and he was nodding along. Both of them were watching the guards in the front of the boat. They were just a few feet away, struggling to hold on to their weapons and stay standing at the same time, perched precariously in the prow like hood ornaments. The water was too rough for them to keep the passengers properly covered. Val tensed up, suddenly worried about what her friend might be planning.
"Guys, let's not do anything stupid,"
she said, but the wind smothered her words. Anna breathed in her ear.
"Follow me. We're going to get the guy in the back."
Val blinked in shock, watching as Justin and the professor began pushing through to the front of the boat, angling for the guards perched in the prow. They hit a particularly large swell, and the guards in the front almost bounced overboard. Before they could recover, both Justin and the professor had reached them and grabbed their rifles.
"Now, girl!"
Anna hissed, but Val was rooted to the spot, frozen with terror. Justin seized the upper hand almost immediately and pushed the first man overboard with a cry and a splash, taking his rifle in the same movement. He turned and slammed the stock into the second guard's stomach while he struggled with the professor. Then that guard went over too, and the professor had his rifle. They turned and swept the weapons back toward the covered section of the boat. Val spun around, suddenly worried about how Anna might have fared without her help, but Anna had the third and final guard covered with his own sidearm, having opted for stealth rather than brute force. The third guardsman's hands were raised above his head, far from the rifle dangling around his shoulders. That only left one more, the woman manning the controls, and her hands were busy with the wheel and the throttle.
"Drop it!"
Anna screamed to the man with his hands raised.
"You heard her,"
Justin added from the front, raising the stolen rifle to his shoulder to aim it over the passengers' heads. Before the third guard could comply, the driver's expression tensed and her eyes hardened. Her arms and shoulders flexed. A sharp jolt of adrenaline shot through Val's system as she realized what she was about to do. Val hit the floor of the boat as the driver wrenched the wheel and sent them tipping up on one side. Passengers cried out and multiple splashes echoed. Val gritted her teeth while clinging to a fiberglass bench seat and the boat's slick sides. The roar of motors quieted and they were turning more gently the other way, bobbing violently in the rough water slapping the sides of the boat.
"Get a floodlight!"
someone shouted. Val risked peeking up to see the driver snapping fingers at another man. There was no sign of Anna back there, or of Justin, or the professor in the front. At least 5 or 10 others were bobbing around them in the water screaming for help. Val stood up and watched as the remaining guard produced a handheld floodlight and began sweeping it around.
"Go help them up,"
the driver said.
"Someone needs to keep the others covered, ma'am."
"I'll do it. Give me your rifle."
The man passed his rifle to the driver. She aimed it over the passengers with one hand, while her other stayed on the wheel and throttle. Val watched as he ran around to help people up from the water one at a time. Other passengers joined in, reaching over the sides to help the ones who'd fallen overboard. She eyed those bobbing faces and stringy mops of wet hair, searching for familiar features under the floodlight. But there was no sign of Anna, Justin, or the professor.
"Was this part of the plan?"
she wondered.
"Try to take control of the boat and jump overboard if that failed?"
Soon the water emptied out and they cruised slowly back the other way, searching for the two who'd gone over first. Another Zodiac slowed as it pulled alongside.
"Everything all right over there, Sergeant?"
"We had a little mutiny, but it's all settled now,"
the driver shouted.
"We have a few men overboard if you want to help us look."
"Copy that."
The next 15 minutes were spent circling around searching the water. They eventually found both men, but still no sign of Anna, Justin, or the professor. Val shivered and hugged her shoulders.
"That's it,"
the sergeant at the back of their boat said, wheeling around.
"Thanks for the help."
"Don't mention it,"
the driver of the other Zodiac replied, and then both boats were roaring over the water heading for the container ship.
"Wait!"
Val cried. She stood up and stared straight at the woman driving the boat.
"What about the others?"
Crow's feet scrunched up around slitted eyes as the sergeant realized who Val was talking about.
"The mutineers?"
She shook her head.
"They want to leave so badly, let them. They're about to find out why a billionaire spent his fortune on this project, ungrateful bastards."
Val swallowed thickly and peered out over the moonlit water to the shore. It was a long way, but Anna used to be on the swim team. She would make it. Hopefully her brother and the professor would, too. Turning towards the container ship, another shiver coursed through Val. They'd escaped, but what about her? What awaited her at the Eden facility? Was it aboard the container ship, or was that just another stage of the journey? Her gaze dropped to the rippled water racing by in a blurry sheet beside her. Maybe she should jump overboard, too. 18. Roland. 4 days left. Roland's eyes snapped open. He'd been sleeping, and judging by the layer of dew over his body, he'd been out for a few hours. The sun was desperately attempting to sneak through the dark, low-level cloud cover, but was failing miserably. Roland shifted from side to side, rotating his ankles and wrists, easing his aching bones. He was tucked away beneath some leafy tree branches near the edge of the fence, with a clear line of sight on the warehouse's bay doors, as well as the loading pier over the rocky outcropping at the ocean's coast. The air was fresh out here, and Roland fought back a sneeze. It had been a long time since he'd been exposed to so many sights and smells, especially in real life. He'd spent the last 10 years hiding inside his grandmother's house, staring at a computer screen. Part of him was exhilarated to be in the field, to be putting himself out here, having the courage and tenacity to do something like this. The other part was terrified and thought he was being a dumbass for risking his own skin.
"It's for the greater good,"
he whispered to himself, although that wasn't quite true. He didn't care about the rest of humanity. This was more about his innate desire to learn the truth, to discover what exactly he'd spent the last couple of years tracking. If Lewis Hound was here, Roland had to learn why. He'd stayed here all night and hadn't seen a thing, not one single movement. Had he even heard a bird chirp? He listened, and the sound of birds cawing and singing hit his eardrums. It was funny how many things transpired when you weren't paying attention to them.
"Okay, so there are birds. But am I too late?"
he asked the air. It didn't answer. Roland slid his phone out and checked his usual sources. Iceland was worse. Far worse. The Pacific Plate was so close to them, and it linked to the others, cutting through the Caribbean to South America. A thought slapped Roland across the face, and he went completely still, frozen by the mere idea. Had Lewis Hound created something to cause all of these weather disturbances? It wasn't totally out of the question. If he made devices and planted several of them strategically around the plates, perhaps inside the fault lines and inside the active fissures, then he could speed up the inevitable. Time it just right, and you'd have doomsday. But what about the hurricanes and the toxic fog or the droughts? Roland wasn't an expert on those, but he figured a man of Hound's means could potentially figure out how to cause those disasters, too. What was inside this warehouse? Would Roland find evidence of these machines created to bring around humanity's demise? Would Hound ransom the world? But to what end? He was already the second richest man in the world. What more could he want? One word scrolled across Roland's mind.